Hello and welcome to the Third Opinion Uncensored, where we are allowed to speak openly about health, public health, wellness and censorship. Today we will be interviewing Dr. Jayanthi Kunasadan, and Dr. Jayanthi was a consultant anaesthetist. Oops, we've just lost her. We will just keep on doing the intro until we get her back on the line. Dr. Jayanthi was a consultant anaesthetist at a major regional Victorian public hospital in practice for more than 12 years until she was mandated out of her job in October of 2021. She has a clinical interest in patient blood management, where she spearheaded many initiatives that sustainably brought down the unnecessary transfusion rates in major surgeries, leading to improved patient outcomes and lower cost to the health system. Dr. Jayanthi is an extremely ethically minded doctor with a passion for using her medical knowledge to help people and patients according to her oath and code. She's a firm believer in evidence-based individualized care. There is no one-size-fits-all approach to everyone's health. She is now an executive member of the Australian Medical Professional Society, AMPS, a group of doctors who want to provide an alternate voice to the Australian Medical Association. Yeah. They wanted to join tens of thousands of other Australian workers who have decided to form independent associations under their Red Union banner. She is one of many Australian doctors being persecuted for wrong think by the government bureaucracy, ARPRA. ARPRA stands for the Australian Health Practitioner Regulation Agency. She's been speaking out on behalf of her colleagues. Can you hear me, Jayanthi?
Can you hear me?
Ah, yes, we can now. Hello. Hello.
Okay, that's good. That's good.
Okay.
I'm glad you can hear me.
So tell me, we've just done a little bit of an introduction. So please, maybe to start with, tell us a little bit about your background as a doctor and how you came to work with AMPS.
So I'm an anaesthetist and perioperative physician. So I'm Malaysian and I migrated to Australia more than a decade ago. Mm-hmm. Generally, one of the reasons that I migrated was I was getting tired of there's racial discrimination in Malaysia, and I was tired of my abilities being judged by race, and I wanted to be judged on merit, and that was a big impetus about for my migration to Australia. Mm-hmm. And so I passed the exams, and then I settled in a regional Victorian town, and I was pretty happy. I was just telling someone else before, I've done the anaesthetic exams twice, so I must really like anaesthetic. So I was pretty happy with my career, and then I did perioperative medicine as well, and I was chair of the Victorian Advisory Committee for Blood Matters Victoria, and my clinical interest was patient blood management. So I was pretty happy till, you know, COVID happened, and then we can talk about what happened in COVID. But so I was actually initially very much into the narrative, and when I
What do you mean about the narrative? So just assume
so,
that the
I didn't question the first year of COVID, which let me think now, that would be 2020. You know, early on, I bought into lockdowns. I didn't really understand there was early treatment. I thought the whole hydroxychloroquine thing was funny, but in a sense, I was the conventional doctor. Like, I was staying in my lane, and I was thinking everyone in public health was, you turn up for work and you think you're doing the best for your patient. So you think that on the other side, everything's, as it should be. Like, we're all working in our own, we're all little cogs in the wheel, and we're doing our best for the optimal outcome for patients. So I just, when they told you wear a mask, I wore a mask, and I was actually, when the vaccines were approved, I was prepared to take it, because I just thought, it'll be just another thing to do. And I think somewhere around there, I saw Pierre Corey's testimony, and it really moved me.
Can you explain for the audience who Pierre Corey is?
So Pierre Corey's testimony, and he was talking about ivermectin, and that was the first time that I started paying attention to the censorship. And when you actually pay attention to censorship, and, you know, he had this testimony on YouTube and then you couldn't
find
it.
This is from, just to explain to the audience, that this was coming from America, and he's a emergency room physician, and he was giving testimony in the U.S. Senate about early treatment. Is that, that's, I think that's what you were referring
exactly.
to.
Exactly. Yeah. It was early mm-hmm. treatment. I think it was his second testimony. Mm-hmm. The first testimony was steroids, and I hadn't caught that. The second testimony was ivermectin. And like, I'm an anesthetist, so I know the name Pierre Corey. I've seen his name in publications. And then I looked up a little bit, I read a little bit more about ivermectin, and I looked up Paul Merrick, and, you know, Paul Merrick's like the guru for intensive care. So, like, I knew these names, and then I started questioning. And as I said, with censorship, the thing people need to pay attention to is you have to pay attention to what you're not allowed to see. And then the scary thing comes as to the person who holds the power to what you can see and doesn't, and you can't see, is actually the most powerful, isn't it? Because all our perceptions and what we are reacting to come from the input we get. And a lot of the division that has been around is because people are reacting only to the input they get, and they don't see what you see.
So, Jayanthi, so you saw this, and then you started to think differently than to the people around you. Is that what you're saying? And you were starting
no,
to...
No, I started to question. Okay. Because I really... Mm-hmm. For me, it was like, it was a no-brainer. Like, you know, you have a safe drug. Mm. And I was like, this... So if you think about it, like, I was a conventional doctor. I had full faith in the system. And I thought, we're all just doing our best for patients. I'm doing my best in patient blood management. You know, I was screening patients as extra work just to make sure they were all good to go prior to surgery. I was doing that. And, you know, I was contributing to good patient outcomes. So I thought on the other side, whatever advice that was coming was done with the same way I was doing my work. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then... You know, when you have a safe drug that's given to like billions of people.
So you're talking about hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin.
I was talking about ivermectin.
Ivermectin.
Because
okay.
I said, I paid attention only after Pierre Corey's testimony. So mm-hmm. I was pretty asleep during the hydroxychloroquine wars. And then after that, it was the ivermectin wars, pretty much. And so the way I look at it, it was so dishonest to deny people this medication, because at the end of the day, even if in whatever interpretation of the data you want to put and say that you say the drug is not effective, at the end of the day, you have to admit the drug is safe. And the worst thing that could have happened is nobody had parasite infection. So that whole thing in 2021, when you know there was the whole, you know, ivermectin, the horse dewormer, etc. Mm, that whole mm-hmm. journey. That mm-hmm. was when I really paid attention. And then you mm-hmm. had to come to the realization there was a lot of corruption. And for me, the saddest part.
Are you
part
talking
was,
about in Australia or overseas or like
around the world? Around the world, it was all the same playbook, wasn't it? So. And for me, it was like the saddest part was that doctors were going along with it because, you know, you needed doctors to be the people who were saying these things. It's a horse dewormer or don't go near it. And so, you know, I was doing the reading and the research. And to my estimation, the medical profession allowed itself to be neutered when we allow effective early treatment to be taken away from
Hi,
the armament.
Michael here.
Yes,
how did the doctors allow this to happen? You're talking about a situation where you have government bureaucrats who are giving instruction to medical professionals on clinical action. Now, if there's a drug that was undoubtedly safe and questionably effective, how could it get to a point where a government could ban it? I mean, that's unprecedented. And
it is.
The point of this is when you said this to your colleagues professionally at work, how did they not come along with you?
So they thought I was crazy. So they just looked at me as if, you know, I had grown three other heads. And the thing is that, like, you know, we're all, if I look at it back, like, we're all so busy. So there's that inherent trust in authority. And then,
you were saying that you trusted the authority, and that generally that there has been trust in Australia for the authority. So something shifted. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah. So Eva, what it actually required, the whole pandemic, is like, yes, you had to think, but thinking is scary, isn't it? And the other part of the thinking is that if you came to a conclusion it was not right, you actually had to take an action. And the opportunity cost for those who took certain actions, like I got fired, you know, traumatized, you know, obviously living unvaccinated in Victoria has been terrible. You know, that whole period when we couldn't go to shops and stuff. And so
when you made a decision not to get vaccinated, what yes. happened? Like, was that a difficult decision to make? I imagine there weren't that many doctors making that decision at the time.
Yeah, so for me, the decision was made when I saw people being shot in the back in the shrine when they were running away by the police. And for me, those bullets were shot in the name of the medical profession. And I had such a bad feeling. Like, it was like, you know, I thought to myself, like, this is done in the name of medicine. And, you know, that time, obviously, AMS, you know, wasn't AMS. And there was nowhere to go. If you were a doctor who felt that way, like, the AMA actually came out and said, like, we should accept a suppression of rights. So if you think, if you're a doctor and you don't think we should accept a suppression of rights, you really had nowhere to go. And think about it, Eva, I'm a migrant, I'm a woman. So like for me, I was thinking like, you know, like surely I'm not going to be the one standing up. Like where, you know, like in a sense, I was asking where are the men? And there were very few. And I didn't think I would be standing up. I'm like, oh my God, like, you know, and if you think about it for a migrant who comes from, like I'm from Malaysia where I was chronically censored, you know, that fear was so, when you're growing up, you know, Dr. Mahathir called Paul Keating recalcitrant, but in Malaysia, recalcitrant people were put in prison for saying the wrong thing. So it was pervasive fear.
So can I just understand? So you didn't expect, you've come from Malaysia and censorship is part of the culture there?
Yes.
Do you think because you're from Malaysia that your response to this may be different to other people because you were responding to something familiar?
Well, I think also my background is Sri Lankan Tamil. So when you're people affected by genocide, you're aware of these things. And like my grandparents left Malaysia to come to left Sri Lanka to come to Malaysia because of the rape. And like in Sri Lanka, you know, the language, they wanted to deny you education, your own language and stuff. So that whole thing, like I've been aware of it. But the part of the response of what I was growing up with was like, you know, be grateful for the relative peace and just get on with it. And then it comes to a point of, you know, at this point, as a doctor, do I just, you know, vaccinate myself and get on with it? Or do I take a stand? And I thought to myself, I thought about my grandparents' journey. I thought about my parents as well, you know, because we were discriminated in Malaysia because of race and stuff. And I thought to myself, at this point, I probably have more resources than my grandparents and parents. So I decided I would take a stand.
Which brings me kind of back to my question from before.
Yep.
You took action because of your history and you're aware of what could happen. And your colleagues at work, I'm guessing if they're medical professionals, they've had at least a middle-class background, well-educated, you know, they're dedicated people who can get a job done. And through their medical studies, they have to be familiar with how you judge if something is right or wrong on a clinical basis. So when that's taken away, how can they, again, I come back to how could they not react in a manner to you? And one hypothesis I might have is that we in Australia, Midnight Oil saying our shorelines were never invaded, our country was never in flames. Do you think that we have no concept? And the reason I bring this up is I've had a chance to speak to the masses during the campaigns that have been federal and state, and it seems to be that people that come, for example, from Eastern Europe or Asian countries where authoritarian government has suppressed the population, they kind of get that it's possible. And I'm thinking that we very comfortable white man Aussies just have no idea of what it can be to have a government take control of the population in the way that it's happening now.
Exactly. And I think it's not taught in history. And the one thing also is that we are a population that doesn't want uncomfortable conversations in Australia.
Yes.
So I'm conservative and I say that proudly now, but you know, for the longest time, you know, when I had a job, I felt like I was morally in, you know, the thing is that, like, if you're not woke or you're not supporting certain causes, you feel you're morally inferior. So I had that when I was interacting with a lot of my colleagues, like, you know, I didn't think the same way they did or stuff like that. But I also think at some point we couldn't have conversations that were nuanced enough because people would take umbrage. So there's that division. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
And I think knowledge about these things, like, it's not taught in history. So people, you know, people don't really know if you, and maybe because I like to read and I like to, so, you know, I think you need to have had that curiosity about just a little bit of history, maybe like last 100 years, and then maybe you could keep delving. But, you know, if you, and I think it's not really present in the younger generation, or definitely not in a lot of my colleagues. Like, you know, it's that understanding of history was not as, I think it just never really realized the true underlying story of quite a lot of the problems. You know, like, people don't really understand the Nazi Party was actually a socialist party, you know, really simple things. Things like that. And as I said, we've come to a point where, because of comfort, people don't want to have uncomfortable conversations. And so you can't even explore this. And, you know, at work, you have to be so politically correct. So you can't have those conversations at work. And then your social circles diminish around the way you look in the world, isn't it? So some people don't want you around the dinner table after a while. So it becomes that. And so then the other circles, I think, they self-perpetuate, and they're probably more, you know, they probably watch a lot more mainstream media, so they don't question.
Speaking of the mainstream media, you're speaking with Jayanthi Kunadasan on J-Air FM 88.
And this is The Third Opinion Uncensored.
Please. Uncensored.
And we really appreciate, Jayanthi, that you have done, you've taken a incredibly courageous step forward. You've been part of AMPS. Not only have you been part of this group of doctors who wanted to provide an alternate voice to Australian doctors, but you've also taken things a little bit further, haven't you? I'd love you to share a little bit about getting involved in this research project with the very once esteemed Dr. Naomi Wolf, and how you got involved with that and how that might have been part of your journey of recovering from what you've just been sharing.
Thanks, Eva. So, you know, when I got fired, like, I think for 1 or 2 months, I used to get ready in the morning and, you know, as if I was going to work.
Yeah.
And you're like, what do I do now? You know, because you know, it was, you know, like, I was full, it was full on, and you're like, what do I do with my time?
When was actually that? When were you fired?
So I, you know, we couldn't enter the workplace after October 2021,
mm-hmm.
and I formally got fired in December.
Can I just check in? Have you previously had all your vaccines required for work prior to this?
Yeah, and I got that year, I got the flu vaccine just to tell them that I'm not anti-vax. You know, the kind of medicine that I am, I don't want the... you know what kind of doctor I am? I'm the pro when the benefits outweigh the risk doctor. That's the label. You know, I don't want the vax label. My label is benefits more than the risk.
And so you're looking at things through data, and you're looking at things on the balance of risks versus benefits. And
in the first place, it should be, do you need the medication?
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll go towards risk benefit.
Okay.
So that's my. So,
okay.
So I got fired December 2021. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then after that, you know, I was like, what do I do? And
ready,
so,
ready for work. What work?
I know, you're just like, you know, it was so traumatic. Like I don't think I've recovered, to be honest. So mm-hmm. I'm still traumatized, mm-hmm. but I'm obviously better. I'm now I'm like so busy. But so I told myself I'll get involved in everything to help bring the truth forward and stand up for what is right. So then I got involved. So I scrutineered in the Australian election and then I joined AMPS, and they were, you know, we were like terrorized. You know, we used to have secret meetings, like, you know, dissident doctors used to have secret meetings and stuff like that. So we were, you know, very much afraid. And then when I saw a call for...
Did you have more than four in the room when you had your secret meetings?
It was very secret, so you can't know. And then, I will not divulge anything.
What were you worried would happen, just out of interest? Because you're
everybody was... It was that pervasive sense of fear and terror. And, like, everybody's just worried about their livelihoods. And those doctors who were still working were, like, you know, anxious that their identity not be revealed. So, you know, we'd have meetings and, you know, anyone who didn't identify...
Can you just explain? So you're saying there were people in the meetings who were still working. They agreed that there was something very wrong, but they hadn't spoken publicly.
Yes. Yeah, they hadn't spoken publicly. So we were respecting everyone's space where they were.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're just trying to bring everyone along and providing support. Because when I got fired, I was like, I don't understand how I feel like I was the only person in this town where I'm living in who thinks this way. Like, this mm-hmm. is, I thought I was insane. So I used to go back and look at the data and think about it. And I'm like, no, this looks right, you know. And I used to do that because, you know, when you're actually facing the loss of your job, like, you have to be really sure.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, I was so naive. I actually thought maybe they didn't know what I was seeing. So I wanted the risk assessment process to educate them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That was what I was trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was like, no, you know, off you go. Back, where, you know, bye-bye.
So you're saying that even when you presented your understanding of the risk assessment process, you were not being heard or not being understood?
So they didn't even want to engage in a risk assessment process. And and if you think about it, you know, if they don't even want to engage in a risk assessment process, I am not the problem. They are.
So there's a censorship happening at a different level. So it sounds like there was a relational censorship between doctors with different views.
So this was between me and my previous employer.
Mm-hmm.
It was, we don't want to hear whatever you want to say. You just have to get your vaccine certificate. And the letters became more and more threatening as I was being fired.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I was like, risk assessment, let's do a risk assessment. And in part, that process of me trying to do a risk assessment with them was that I was naively thinking they don't know what I'm seeing. So maybe I'll help them and educate them and I can save, you know, like prevent harm or save people. And I thought they would listen to me.
Mm-hmm.
How did that go for you?
Pardon?
How did that work out for you?
Well, it didn't work out, did it? So, you know, I got fired. So it is, but as I said, like, when you're the one asking for a risk assessment, which should be the, you know, how can doctors assess, say, I'm not doing harm if you're not even assessing risk?
Mm.
And as I told myself, because I kept going back and looking at the documents and the data and the journals, and I'm like, you know, if you think about it, like common sense, like, you know, my stance and what I asked for was very reasonable, but it was so, you know, it was full on, you know, maximum terror that they inflicted on people. Like I felt, as you know, as the letters from my previous employer were getting more threatening, I felt if I don't remove myself from this, they're going to come. I felt they were going to actually assault me with a needle. It is what I felt.
Wow.
You know, the last day of my work, you know, I'd get more letters, and then you can't talk about it to anyone. So I, at that point, I told myself, if I don't remove myself from this, they're actually going to, you know, they're going to come after me with the needle. Like that's how I felt, as I was going to be assaulted with the needle.
So you're saying, so even though that's not likely to have happened, you felt that was the level
I
of threat and
that
fear.
Was what happened.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you couldn't speak about it because you said,
you know, they tell you don't speak about it to anyone. Oh. Then you'll be,
okay.
You know, in these letters, it's terrible experience being fired, let me tell you. But they tell you not to tell anyone. And, you know, you're so scared and you know, you don't really have anyone to talk to.
Yeah, yeah.
Were there any of your colleagues in the same situation?
No. So I was the only one and I couldn't talk about it to them.
And this is before you met the group through AMPS that you're talking
about.
So,
yes.
So then you suddenly had a community of people who were going through similar experiences, I imagine.
Not very many people actually got fired the way I did.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody really had my full-on trauma, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's very traumatic being fired.
Mm-hmm.
And for no reason, like, you know. So not many people had my, but I met other like-minded doctors. Because prior to that, you can imagine, I'm in my workplace, all my doctor friends think I'm crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm like, I don't think so. You know, and then
so let's just go forward, because at that time there was evidence, but there wasn't the huge amount of evidence that there is now. So you were seeing enough evidence that made you think a certain way. And that evidence was obviously not being taken into account by the government authorities that were making the decisions. Now we have a lot, you know, now we have many, many people, and it seems that even Dr. Asim Malhotra, the cardiologist from the UK, who now has been calling for the COVID vaccines in the UK to be halted.
Yeah.
He's going to be visiting us here soon, I hear.
Yes, by app. Yes, but just to go back, Eva, so at that point, I was like, do you need it? So in my head, remember, because I talk so much about ivermectin, if you had this medication and I was doing all the FLCCC protocol, so I had my treatment kit ready.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, with the vaccination at that point, there were many signals of concern.
Okay.
We didn't have
yes.
a lot. We didn't know as much about it as we do now,
mm-hmm.
but there were many signals of concern. So it should have never been something that was forced on anyone.
And resulting in what sounds like an unfair dismissal. I don't know what the legal situation is, but we've got somebody here in the studio who's listening to this and saying, this sounds like an unfair dismissal. Is there a legal case for you that around that, or is that not something that you're pursuing?
I'm letting AMS take care of the legal side.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll talk about let's go and talk about how I got involved in the study.
Yes.
The Pfizer
okay.
stuff.
And the study is very interesting because really it justifies everything that you decided. And why you made those decisions and how you were, you know, looking at data intuitively, your history of, you know, coming from a place where you were aware of censorship and what that can do in terms of what's truth and how people respond to government authorities. So, tell us about the project. So you got involved with this. You're ready for work and suddenly there's a project emerges in March of 2022.
Yes, yes. And I think you can't remember when we started, but so they called out for a call for volunteers. I've never done anything like this. I'm the initiatives who never even published like a study, you know, and I was, you know, I'm just this practical initiatives. Like, you know, I'll get you through it well, you'll be comfortable, you'll no pain and stuff. But so I wasn't just publishing this one, but like, you know, I can read papers and I have common sense. So I thought, I had no idea if I was able to contribute anything. But the thing is that, you know, it was a time of extreme isolation, because, like, you know, the mandates, I mean, I think we were still a segregated society in Victoria. So it was just an opportunity to meet with other people as well. So, you know, I must say the team that I've connected with through the internet, you know, the other volunteers, like, they're the best of humanity.
Can you explain, maybe I'll just go back and say there was a call out. Dr. Naomi Wolf was, and she was on a radio show, was it, or a podcast with...
So she was on Steve Bannon's War Room.
Okay,
that sounds... Call Out for Volunteers. Yes. Yeah, because they're like 400,000 pages.
And so explain what the pages were. So this was at the time that there was a judge in America had just ordered Pfizer and the FDA to publicly release tens of thousands of pages of documentation that have been used to assess the safety and efficacy of Pfizer's mRNA COVID vaccine due to a Freedom of Information request submitted by attorney Aaron Seary. So that's the story behind it. And people didn't expect that the judge was actually going to say, you have to release it, but he did. And there's suddenly these tens of thousands of pages of documentation. And what happened was, Dr. Naomi Wolf puts out a call saying that, you know, we need to understand what's in there, but there's just way too much. You know, it was just a huge amount of information. And suddenly they have 3,500 volunteers who are, I believe, medical doctors, scientists, people who look at censorship, all sorts of people. And you are one of that group of people, correct?
Yes.
Data analysts, et cetera. So what was your role, and what has been uncovered over the past year or more?
So I'm one of the volunteers. So we are in different teams, and basically we initially what happened was we get assigned like pages to read, and then you do a report. But you know, you have to. What I uncovered, and then I'll talk about what they have, the entire team has uncovered. So there've been now, I think, 68 reports. The first 50 reports have now been compiled into a book, which you can actually buy on Amazon.com, Pfizer War Room Daily Cloud Documents Analysis Book. And basically, it's all reports on what is found in the documentation. And this, you have to remember, is the basis of the EUA approval for the Pfizer-BioNTech mRNA vaccine. So the report that I was involved in, so, you know, it's the report, all the documents that are available that were used for approval of this drug, there's like more than... There are hundreds of thousands of documents. So I don't know how the FDA evaluated it in, like, you know, also warp speed. But so there's a lot of the safety data, and that's formed the bulk of the reports that have been available, and they're continuing. So there's the post-marketing data as well. So in the first 3 months, there were 42,000 adverse events, and there were 1,220 deaths. So all that is elucidated now in different organ classes, and you can get those reports on the dailyclot.io website. There's also the biodistribution. You know, they told you it was just going to stay in your arm, and you know, obviously that didn't happen, and all those reports are available on the Daily Cloud website. So now my report is actually based on the efficacy. So efficacy is, you know, they've said that this drug is safe and effective. The effective part of it comes from the efficacy data. So they only based the judgment that this drug is effective was only based on the results of 170 patients.
Hang on a second. We were told that it was based on 40,000. Is that right? How many?
44.
44,000. And you're saying 44, it was only based...
44,000, okay. Eva. And then it becomes 43,651. Yeah.
So 170. Now, how is that possible? How is it possible that information... I mean, really, everywhere that you would look, people would say, this has been tested for safety. It's been tested on huge amounts of people. And we feel that, you know, this is fine to go ahead. How could the TGA approve something if it was only based on 170 people? And please explain the 170 people. How does those numbers fit into the, you know, how does that get contracted to such a small number?
Yep. So the requirements, like they wanted safety data for two, and this was a new requirement, and we can talk about that. But basically, safety data was basically on half the trial population. So yes, they did recruit 44,000 patients, but you have to remember the endpoint of this trial is comparing the incidence of those who get COVID, for patient years and stuff. But they were going to compare the incidence between the vaccinated group and the placebo. And then that's where you get the 95% efficacy. So to get this, and it was only at a certain time frame. So right after the injection, if you got COVID, you couldn't be counted towards the efficacy analysis for the primary endpoint of the trial.
So you're saying that if you got COVID within the first few weeks of having the vaccine.
So if you got COVID less than 7 days after dose two, you couldn't be eligible for the primary endpoint of the trial.
Right.
So it's, Michael, please help me because I know I explained too much, but I've been living in this data and I have to work on explaining it simply. But essentially, every trial has a primary endpoint and you need a certain population that goes through the trial correctly so they don't have protocol deviations. For this trial, you had to receive two doses and they would compare the incidence of getting COVID 7 days after dose two. So, and then these are the eligible population, and then they planned an interim analysis. So they were going to declare this drug efficacious as soon as they got a certain number of cases. They weren't going to wait for to see what happened to the whole 44,000. So initially they planned an interim analysis if they had found enough 32 patients who had gone through the trial correctly, and after 7 days from dose two, they actually got COVID, they would explore and see how many in that population were vaccinated and placebo. But what happened?
Okay, so you're saying that they were assessing that when people got COVID 7 days after that dose, they would look at those people and say, how many of you are vaccinated and how many of you aren't? Is that correct?
Yes.
And are they looking at how severely they've got COVID? Are they looking at people dying?
That was some parts of the other analysis, Eva. But so the main thing is to understand they were planning to do interim analysis when there were 32 eligible cases, 62 eligible cases, 92 eligible cases, 120. And they said at that point they only needed 164 such cases. If they got 164 cases, they would compare the incidence of COVID between the vaccinated and placebo. And depending on the results of 164 cases, they could declare whether the drug was efficacious or not. So that's why you ended up with the 170 number, because it was close enough to that 164.
Is this the same information that Pfizer didn't want to release for another 75 years?
Yes, this is the information Pfizer didn't want to release. So imagine the 170 patients are actually the most important patients in the trial, because it is based on their data. Like, you know, whatever people say now that, you know, it's defense, this one, and it's all theater or whatever, the accrual of the 170 was the performance. You know, you can say a drug's safe, but you got to deliver a drug that you say is effective. And if you say the drug's going to be effective after I've analyzed 160 plus cases that are eligible, this is actually the most important patient population in the trial.
So, but they're not looking at these people for all-cause harm, all-cause mortality, or all the other things. And this is where you talked before about risk-benefit. The only thing they're measuring is whether they got COVID or not. Is that the only measure that was being used?
Yes. The criteria to be part of the 170 is you had to have two doses of the drug given correctly.
Or of the placebo,
Drug or placebo given correctly in the according to the protocol with no major protocol deviations.
Okay. And that was all they looked at. And then they said, you've got COVID. So it's not about, of those 170, that people from one group were healthier than the other. It was just whether they contracted COVID. That was the only thing they measured.
It was the incident.
PCR test or on what basis?
Yeah, so it was symptomatic COVID, and it was only based on one symptom.
What symptom was it? What symptom could you have to say
there
that you've
nine
got COVID?
Symptoms. Diarrhea is one of them.
Yeah.
I look at this thing and I'm
so what else?
How many times in medicine do you diagnose something just based on one symptom?
Wow.
Anyway, I remember, studying for my exams, like 3 out of 5 or whatever.
Anyway,
it's one symptom and the PCR test. And remember, the PCR test for this was done in Pearl River in the central laboratory in New York.
And that means what?
So the test for the PCR to determine so you had to have symptoms, but you had to test positive. So symptomatic disease was what they called it. The PCR test for this, this trial was done in many countries around the world, many sites in the US, in South Africa, in Germany, Argentina and Brazil. All the test results, the PCR, went back to New York.
Okay, and then they did the analysis there. I see we've only got 7 minutes left.
Oh, a bit less than that.
Okay, so let's we just have to start winding it up. Do you want to just tell us overall what else has been discovered, like in terms of what's been the most shocking data that has come out of this analysis of the tens of thousands of pages of...
Just to go back to the 170, Eva, if you think about it, they had to be the most perfect patients in the trial because the trial was approved based on their results.
Yes.
One of them didn't even receive the correct dose of the investigational product.
Mm-hmm.
Five of them, the dosing interval was changed. Their dosing interval was not what was written in the protocol. Two of them were withdrawn from the trial but still included in the 170. And it was all cherry-picking because along the way, more vaccinated people than unvaccinated people were taken away from the trial. They were excluded.
Ah.
And the other thing is the timing of the 170. They said they would do... And remember I talked about the 32 cases?
Mm-hmm.
They had... The U.S. election was there, and I think there was a push by certain doctors and certain medical professionals not to have a vaccine declared before the election.
Mm-hmm.
So the FDA and there was a – and I've written about this in the Spectator article.
So let me just say there's a meeting. So if people are interested, they can go to the spectator.com.au.
It was March 24th. So they had a meeting and basically they said, we're not going to do it at 32 cases. We're not going to do an interim analysis. We're going to do it when it's more than 62. So the point I want to make before we end is more than 62 cases were accrued based on the data in the hidden documents that we weren't supposed to see for 75 years. It was accrued in the last week of October and they sat on it for more than 2 weeks and only announced in November 8 that they had accrued, they had done an interim analysis in the first place and they said they did it at 94 cases. So when they announced on November 8 that there were 94 eligible cases, the At that point, if you look at the Pfizer documents, they actually got about 133 patients.
I just want to sneak in one question before we finish. Have you received an apology from the people who sacked you?
No, of course not.
Have they... everybody, there's plenty of evidence, like we're just talking about now, that it doesn't stop transmission, and that was the reason that you were sacked. Wouldn't somebody be coming along to explain that perhaps they'd made an error and apologise for that?
No, not at all. And Michael, because I've been speaking out and, you know, I've said that I don't think doctors who tell patients that, you know, I think I can quietly tell you this drug causes your harm, but I can't tell it publicly. I don't think that's an honourable way to practice medicine. I'm being investigated by APRA for that.
Have you bumped into any of the colleagues that perhaps... Okay, we have to finish this up.
But you now have got the esteemed Dr. Philip Altman, who has worked with the TGA for over 40 years in doing trials, who is speaking out also very, very strongly about what's been happening. And you have many other doctors who are part of AMPS who are supporting this. I think some of the data that's come out of this Pfizer document analysis is shocking in terms of the harm that was happened during some of the vaccination harm was already in the documents that hadn't been released. So I think there's a lot there. I don't think that the details of what you're talking about is people are able to absorb that, because it's very detailed, and without looking at the data in front of you, because we're on radio, it's difficult to show. But what I'm hearing is that you are doing part of this team who are doing incredibly important work, and we have to finish up the show.
So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
There's an incredible amount of information to unpack there, folks.
And maybe we'll have you on the show again, and maybe when Dr. Malhotra's here as well, perhaps we can get him onto the show. It would be great to talk about that and how they've been successful in the UK, because obviously the UK has put now, but it's no one's getting the COVID vaccines under the age of 65, is it? What's happened there?
Let's talk about
APRA. Yeah, I think they've been more successful because more healthcare workers stood up there.
Okay, all right. Maybe we'll talk about APRA next time was the suggestion. So maybe we can put that together for the next time we speak. So let's have a chat and work out what we can focus on to support you in your work. And I just really want to thank you for your courage. I saw you speaking out, and you know, I listened to what you were saying, and I really felt that the fact that you came from elsewhere and recognised what was happening was a big part of your courage. And I think that you gave a lot of other people courage. Thank you very much. This is The Third Opinion Uncensored.
We should talk about the institutions that provided the medical information for the government to make those decisions.
This is Dr.
We can't stop you guys, can we?
We've been speaking to Dr. Jayanthi Kunadasan.
She's gone.
Kunadasan. She's gone. Okay. And thank you, anyone who's listening. If you want to send in any questions to JAIR, you can do that. Thank you, Sean,
at jair.com.au. Don't forget membership for those that want to join our station and provide much needed income for our shows like this. Controversial shows like this. You couldn't have had a show like this 2 years ago.
And thank you, JA, for being an uncensored radio station.
We would have had the health department marching in the door, dragging us.
Can I help you, officer?
The sheriff's come to get us. No, we'll be right. I think very important discussions to be had.
I think uncensoring is very important. And for people like Jayanthi, who's been through a terrible time.
I think she needs a good lawyer.
To stand up like that, she's a hero. Mm. She's a real hero.
All right,
okay,
guys.
Thank you so much.
Stand by for Jeremy and Robert in the jazz show at 6 o'clock. I think it's going to be 6 o'clock.
This is Eva and Michael and Sian, and this is Jay Air.